Hello, good afternoon. My name is Catherine Flynn, and I'm a Boston Book Festival board member. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Deconstruction of Myth. It's also my pleasure to welcome you to the 15th anniversary of the Boston Book Festival. And I'm here to say briefly that the BBF can't put on a festival without donations. And to keep all of these events free and open to the public and in the beautiful venues across Copley Square that we all get to experience together. So I ask you to go online and donate or to visit the Boston Book Festival membership tent by the public library and sign up to be a member there. Thank you, and now I would like to tell you there are books for sale in the back at the end, and I will turn it over to one of my favorite novelists, Don Tripp.
Thank you so much, Catherine, and thank you all so much for being here. Thank you, Hajin. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Susanna. I love the Boston Book Festival. I came here for the first time presenting my third novel, and to me, it was just magical. Just a magical opportunity for writers and readers to come together, to hold space for the stories that we tell and the way books help us make sense of ourselves, one another, and our place in the wider world. So I love this festival so much, and your presence here, the fact that we have so many of you here, it matters. And so thank you so much for being here. So I'm grateful to be here with Emily, Hajin, and Susanna. And, you know, I love the idea of being able to talk about the deconstruction of myth. And three outstanding novelists who have created innovative, brilliant works that revisit myths, epics, and ideals, exploring themes of violence, politics, and gender through an alternative lens. And I believe that myths, like history, can be kaleidoscopic and that they change according to the perspectives through which they are told. So I'd like to briefly introduce each of our three authors, and then we'll begin our conversation. Emily Wilson's 2017 translation of the Odyssey was hailed as a revelation by the New York Times and a cultural landmark by The Guardian. Her Iliad is a sharply resonant translation of Homer's epic, transforming how we read one of the most complex war poems of all time. Winner of the National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award, Hajin has crafted a new transcendent novel inspired by the life of pioneering stage director Sun Weishi. The Woman Back from Moscow is at once the story of a decades-old rivalry between two women and a revelatory examination of the complicated history of the Chinese Communist Party. Acclaimed author Susanna Moore's The Lost Wife is based on the true story of a woman kidnapped by the Sioux in 1862. It has been widely praised as a masterwork, Esquire, and a brief, harsh glimpse of the bloody past that stains the present, The Guardian. The Lost Wife is an emotionally devastating tale, sparely told, that subverts our myth of the American West. So I'd love to have each of you share a brief, very brief passage from your work so that the stories you've told and the words you've used to tell them can be in this room.
Me?
You.
The narrator of my book is a woman called Sarah Brinton. In the book, she's called that. In life, she was called Sarah Wakefield. And I'm going to read to you a passage after she has been in Minnesota Territory for a while. She's living with her husband, who is a doctor at the Indian Agency, serving the reservations of Sioux on the Yellow River. And in these pages, I hope you will see that she's beginning to reject the assumptions of the a sort of hierarchy of civilization. Dr. Brinton is writing what is called a monograph on the Santee, or Eastern Dakota. He says that long ago, they were rice gatherers in the north until the Ojibwe drove them onto the prairie with guns given them by the French. They move camp according to the season and in pursuit of game. He admires their fearlessness, their resourcefulness, their fortitude, their way with horses, their good looks, he said with a smile, not a trait necessarily required for killing buffalo. I am afraid of them for the same reason, I said. He asked if I had ever seen an Indian before coming west. Surely there are Indians in Rhode Island, the Pequot and the Narragansett. I said, of course there are Indians in Rhode Island, but I didn't know any. My great-grandfather, he said, kept two Pequot children as slaves, although my father denied it. They were servants, he said, not slaves. It was one of the few times my husband had ever spoken about his father, who died with his favorite dog and a woman, not his wife, in a mysterious boating accident in Maine. How do you know they were slaves? I asked, a bit shocked. My great-grandfather left them to his daughter in his will, Jack, the Indian boy, age 9. It is true I knew very little about Indians when I arrived in Shakopee 7 years ago. I still know very little. I had read about Indians, of course, in James Fenimore Cooper, as well as Mary Rowlandson's account of her abduction and that of Mary Jemison, and I had heard the story of Eunice Williams, who was captured in Deerfield and chose to stay with her captors, but nothing prepared me for my life now, the Santee, my constant companions. I allow the chiefs to sit at my mother-in-law's dining table. More than that, I invite them inside to eat with us, corn fritters and cherry cobbler, and pork patties, smoked trout, and black currant cordial. Dr. Brinton is amused that several of them now insist on having their own linen napkins. They eat when they are hungry, but as they have observed our curious habit of eating at regular times, they arrive just as we are sitting down. They eat so hungrily that they soon grow sleepy and forget any mischief they may have in mind. One of our guests wears two long rattlesnake skins, one tied to each wrist, which he removes before dining, leaving them on the sofa until he has had his fill. He then asks me to retie them to his wrist, which I do. I don't intend my admiration of them to be a mark of condescension. Their splendor is only the most visible part of them. The idea of who is civilized and who is not seems to refer to many things, religious customs and what stories we tell, and the way food is prepared, and how the defeated in battle are treated, even table manners. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And I would love to have you read the opening.
Yes, so I'm going to read the opening, just 7 lines of the Iliad. And I'm first going to read the original and then my translation. And I hope that you can hear the rhythm. The original is in dactylic hexameter. My translation is in iambic pentameter. Many naida thea peleia du akileos. Ulomenen hemuria chaos alge theca. Polus diphthimus psukas aidi proiapsin, hero on, autus de heloria chuke cunessin, oio noisi de daita, dios de teleet obule. Exude to prin diastaten prota diasteten arisanta atreidesten axandron kai dios achilius. This is my translation. Goddess, sing of the cataclysmic wrath of great Achilles, son of Peleus, that caused the Greeks immeasurable pain, and sent so many noble souls of heroes to Hades, and made men the spoils of dogs, a banquet for the birds. And so the plan of Zeus unfolded, starting with the conflict between great Agamemnon, lord of men, and glorious Achilles.
Oh.
My turn? Okay.
Yes, please.
All right. I'm very happy to be here, to hear the really the haunting voice of Homer's. Really, I admire Emily's translation of the Greek epics. In fact, Odysseus really is a great translation, really a great, magnificent. I read it 2 years ago, and I was deeply impressed. And then I bought another volume of translation by her, a Persian woman. And but anyway, I'm very happy to be here and to be part of this panel. I'm going to, because my book is kind of a historical novel based upon a true historical figure, Sun Weishi, as Don mentioned. But the problem, stylistically, it was very hard. I didn't know how to write a book about her. I could not use her real name because it was very hard to pronounce in English. It would upset the cadence for the sentences. So, but by chance, I came upon a letter she wrote to her aunt. They were of similar age. So she signed Yu Mei as her personal name, almost like a pet name. And I realized that she used such a name among her friends. So I adopted that name that can facilitate the narration. I'm going to read an episode. The context of the episode is right at the establishment of New China. At the end of 1949, the Chinese Communist Party sent Mao and a group of other leaders to Moscow, basically to negotiate with Stalin, also to celebrate Stalin's 70th birthday. And because the New China had announced that it had abolished all the unfair treaties with other powers, other countries, so there were several unfair treaties between China and Russia. So the Chinese government wants to basically take back some rights. For instance, the Siberia Railroad, the Manchuria section, that should be returned to China. Also, the return of Dalian Harbor and the Port Arthur, occupied by the Soviet Navy. So that was the top item on the agenda. Right before this moment, this day, and they had a talk, but at the very first meeting, this subject was basically pushed aside by Stalin. Stalin's argument was, no, this was, we had signed a treaty, unfair to China though, but we signed it with other powers like the United States and Britain, so we cannot change this unilaterally, because that would involve other powers. What if Japan demand the return of the Kuril Islands and some other ramifications? But the Chinese delegates were surprised. They had not considered all the consequences. So at the spur of the moment, they agreed to put this aside. So the talk continued. Stalin promised a very generous financial aid and economic help to China. So the first day the talk ended on a very pleasant note. But after a night of sleep, Mao changed. So here's the at the point he how he changed. In spite of a good night's sleep, Mao was in a foul mood the next morning. That was caused by the stalemate negotiation over the revocation of the old treaty. That had been the main purpose of his visit, but it had been laid aside at the very first meeting. What an imbroglio he was in now. He regretted had agreed not to revise the treaty right away. He could have begged to differ at the meeting, emphasizing that both sides should agree to disagree for now. Now, without any development in this respect, he might have to face criticism in China once he was back. The more he mulled over the frustration, the angrier he became. He told Li Jiaqi, a staffer on his retinue, to remove the spongy mattress, saying it would tend to give him a crick in the neck and make him insomniac, as he was unused to this kind of a comfortable bed. He wanted real wood balls, like the bed he had back home. Jiaqi didn't know where to get wood balls, so he asked Yu Mei to explain the matter to Ivan Kovalev, the Russian official in charge of Mao's daily life here, to see if they could replace the mattress with wood balls. You may believe it would be inappropriate to make a big fuss over such a trifle. Instead, she measured the bed lengthways and crossways, and then reported Mao's demand to Ambassador Wang, who sent a junior diplomat to a furniture store downtown with Yu Mei's measurements and bought some boards. The mattress was replaced that very evening, and Mao was satisfied with the new hard bed. The Russian servants later told Yu Mei that Mao was a genuine revolutionary, still living like a guerrilla in the wilderness. Mao expected that Stalin would meet with him again and discuss the unfinished business, but there was no word from the Kremlin. Now he understood why he had been put up at such a faraway place. Stalin must have meant to keep some distance from him and also to show that he was not the major guest here. And in fact, Stalin had two duchies. One is in downtown Moscow, and the other one is 20 miles away from Moscow in a suburb, and that is called the Sisters River. So the Chinese delegation was put at Sister Rivers. So Mao was upset because he was too far away from the Red Square. So he thought that was kind of isolation and pushing put off from the Kremlin. So Mao was galled, though he knew that Stalin must be busy these days with so many delegates from other Eastern Bloc countries coming to celebrate his 70th birthday. Nonetheless, Mao came up with some more bizarre demand. He wanted to have the toilet changed, claiming that sitting on the nice toilet would make his bowels seize. He needed the more primitive type he had back home, a small rectangular porcelain bowl set in the floor of the bathroom so that he could squat over it. Yu Mei tittered on hearing such a demand and said, "My, this one is like a nail in my head that I don't know how to pull out." Before this point, Yu Mei had performed in Chekhov's Three Sisters. She enacted the middle sister. So she learned the phrase, the idiom, a nail driven into my head, but I don't know how to put it out. And she kept using it. This became part of her language. Eventually, this expression contributes to her destruction. After considering Mao's new demand a moment, she reported to Ambassador Wang, who sighed on the phone, apparently at a loss what to do. "My heavens, Where could I find a mason who can change the toilet for him? He wondered aloud. Besides, that's Stalin's bathroom, and we are not supposed to mess with it. Yumei laughed and then said she was going to speak with Ivan Kovalev, who had lived in China for many years and must have known what a toilet for squatting was like. So she went to see Ivan and explained Mao's demand. Kovalev cracked up and said no Russians but himself knew anything about such a toilet. Moreover, it was Stalin's bathroom, and he'd have to get permission if he had anything done to it. Luckily, he got approval from the Kremlin and then sent over a mason to lay bricks around the toilet, to construct a tiny terrace around it, and even build two steps for Mao to climb up to squat over the hole when he needed to defecate. Yumei placed a roll of toilet tissue at the corner of the mini platform, and then turned to Mao and said, "Please be careful, don't fall from this." Mao laughed and said, "I'm not that frail and old. I just don't want to give them the impression that we Chinese are merely pushovers." In fact, there was a kind of a deal between the Chinese and the Soviets, a diplomatic kind of a struggle. But eventually the Chinese prevailed, partly because the United States and the other Western powers helped. And several countries really they're ready, they're poised to recognize China, read China as the real power.
And one of the things that's so powerful about the section that you read is how you've taken these very personal, intimate details, you know, and you have, you know, worked through a moment that when we read about that in a book or our understanding of history. And that's what I love about these three books, is that they each have taken these kernels of humanness and retold, translated a structure that might have been more fixed in our mind, whether it was the structure of Homer's epic work over time and translations. Like, you know, you, for example, Emily, have, you know, you've taken the, I mean, I would say, and again, I want to hear from you, but you've taken this this story that I've read many times, and you've stripped it back. And so I feel like what I experience is just the emotion and like it's almost like there's an interplay between the mythic and the very human emotion, which I think is so much of what you just were reading, Hajin.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't say that I see my work as a stripping. I mean, I have a lot of repeated epithets,
right,
far more than in some translations. And I also, as I hope was clear from the reading, I'm totally committed to the idea of translating metrical verse in meter, which is, of course, also not the norm in 20th and 21st century American translations of ancient verse texts. So I see it in a way as a putting stuff back rather than stripping away.
But there's a spare, and maybe it's the cadence, there's a blade in how the language unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, reading it, I just feel like I'm cutting through space. Mm-hmm. And I love that, and across time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the directness of Homeric syntax, I mean, Homeric syntax is not at all difficult compared to many other ancient poets. Homeric poetry is designed to be experienced out loud. It has a kind of clarity and emotional directness. And I wanted to convey those qualities in the translation. And I think quite a lot of, especially the contemporary or modern translations, have added in too much,
right,
but actually isn't there. And so if it's not there, it's not that I'm stripping away something from the ancient, it's that I'm saying that isn't there. We don't need to repeat if the original doesn't repeat.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you recited the original, I realized it was very, very physical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lines are very physical. So mm-hmm. your English translation do have that kind of physical echo. Yes.
And that viscerality, which I think is also what you have really captured in Sarah's story, where, you know, these are all So the retelling of, you know, a kind of story, a historical mm-hmm. story. You know, you've written two novels that are based on historical personages, mm-hmm. but you've told them through a different lens, like a very human lens. Yeah. And also, you know, I feel like in this very slim, spare book, Susanna, you have retold the really complicated legacy of the American West and the violence and oppression and conflict that that founded dimensions of it.
Well, retold, translated, restored, but also in my case, made up a lot.
Sure, yeah, yeah, you have to made up. Sometimes you have to change history. For instance, the episode I read, Maud did make those demands. But the change of the toilet happened on his second trip to Moscow. That was in 1957, but I packed both into this visit because it just dramatically the narrative needs that.
And then in terms of making, like, what was it about Sarah's story that originally drew you?
Well, excuse me. A few years ago, I began reading. I became very interested in what are called captivity narratives. And amongst them, I found hers. She had written, Sarah Wakefield had written, she says, for the benefit of her children, her story of her abduction by the Santee Sioux during the uprising of 1862. And it was also a justification of her defense of the Sioux, for which she was vilified and hated. So that got my interest, and also I didn't quite believe her. I didn't think she was insincere or that she was lying, but I think she left out a great deal. There was a lot of piety, a lot of justification, a lot of reference to the Bible, to the part that God played in her rescue. And I just felt, you know, there's something more there. So that's where I started. You know, what was there?
What was that more?
What was that more?
Because sometimes historical narratives and retellings and translations, they can come not out just of what's there, but what isn't there, you know? And it's reading into those negative spaces that we can, you know, approximate or come maybe closer to an emotional or psychological truth.
Yes. And maybe get it wrong. I hope I didn't get things wrong. I took a lot of, you know, there was license used because very little was known about Sarah. I discovered, for example, that she was a bigamist and that she had abandoned a child. Bigamy was very common. It was easy in places like the West, and even Australia is a good example, where you could really reinvent yourself. You could, you know, there were no churches, no judges, no paper. You could completely recreate yourself, and a lot of people did it. Understandably, and she was one of them.
And I was wondering, Emily, if you could talk a little bit about wrath. The word you use is mm-hmm. wrath. And, you know, I've thought so much over the years reading different translations of the Iliad about the way rage and the dialectic between rage and grief incarnate.
Yes, so rage and grief are totally intertwined in the Iliad. The first word of the poem is menin, from menis, which is not the normal term for human anger, which is kolos or menos. Menis is usually used of divine wrath. And so the rage of Achilles is more than normal mortal rage. When normal mortal men are mad at other men, they may kill a few men, but gods can kill multiple men all at once, or people all at once, as when a plague strikes, and then without the god Apollo even having to touch them, many people are dead. And the wrath of Achilles is like that. I use the word wrath because I think it has a sort of biblical, more than human quality in English. And I consistently use wrath and wrathful for the cognates of menis, menimos, because I want the poem's very subtle and distinct language of emotion to come through in the translation. That the poem is actually quite, has this very rich vocabulary, both for the noises of wailing and keening and screaming and grief, the noises of battle cries, and the screams and cries of wrath and anger, which are different from one another.
The human dimension, and I loved the story that you told of finding Yome's name, like just this idea that in one of those little tiny details that you come across in your research, an intimacy is born.
Yes, and in fact, there's another thing, because a story like this, this kind of narrative, because historically, the Chinese communists, they have that convention for suppressing, destroying archives. So a lot of things, facts, are not available anymore. And even the demand for changing a toilet, that was only told by in very personal memoirs. So I collected all the facts, but I have to organize them. That fact alone is, in a way, demystifying all these leaders, the political powers, because they don't want people to know these facts, historical happenings. So basically, the way for organizing history and the perspective through which one tells a story, that already is a kind of demystifying act.
And when I said before that I felt sometimes that the language is stripped, what I meant is that I have read that scene many, many times of Hector and Achilles, and I have never been moved the way I was moved reading yours. That moment of realizing the clarity is what allows for the emotion. And I actually feel that all three of your works, there's, when I say stripped, I mean it in a very positive way. Like there's a kind of, again, it's just this edge and this blade that allows us to feel.
I think you're right, because over time and very often language grow kind of a crust or rust over experience. But whereas new translation, new narrative very often can strip away of it.
And allow us to feel the way it was, you know, originally.
Yes.
Came forth. And your novel, the tone, and what I've always loved about your work is that there's a spareness to the tone that allows us that space between what we're reading and what we imagine is sort of that leap is what allows us to really connect.
I was helped very much when I learned a lot when I was writing a novel of mine called In the Cut 25 years ago, and I wanted to write about sex, which I had not written about before, and which I thought was often written about very badly. I didn't know how to do it, you know, and I looked at a lot of pornography. I read pornography. I read every issue of Playboy for the last 10 years. Needless to say, it taught me what not to do. But what I learned was that all description of smell, touch, sound should be taken out. And if I just wrote what was being done, it opened up this vast space in which people could imagine for themselves or identify. And so this, in a way, this plainness added an eroticism that I had not expected and which people felt. So I think that was a very important lesson to learn.
That's so interesting. I'm thinking now about one of the sex scenes in the Iliad, which is very, very disappointing sex scene when Helen and Paris go to bed together. And of course, you'd think Helen and Paris going to bed together. That starts the whole thing. That must be very important. Yeah. And Aphrodite scoops Paris up off the battlefield and brings him to the bedroom and then forces Helen to go to bed with him. She doesn't want to go. She accuses the goddess of having a crush on Paris and all this. There's this whole sort of scene which at first seems comic and then becomes very chilling, where the goddess led the way. And you know, there's this huge power differential and Helen doesn't have a choice about this if she wants to stay alive. And then it sort of leads up to this one line of then they get to bed and they have sex. And when I did my translation and I shared it with an editor who said, surely you need to soup this up. There needs to be more excitement in this sex scene.
No.
And the original doesn't have excitement because it's actually not about that. It's about this is this, in a way, sort of trivial thing on which so much depends. And that I think sometimes a sort of quietness and clarity can be more horrifying and can be more powerful emotionally. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Absolutely. And the power, like and you bring this forward in your translation of the power dynamics that are at play mm-hmm. constantly, and none of it is obscured by extra language. Like it's all there, and it's there in a way that allows it to cut us mm-hmm. in ways that help us understand mm-hmm. more.
I realized that it was working after in the cut when I got a letter from a woman who said she had had an orgasm on an airplane. I don't necessarily believe her, but it was a great compliment.
It's the same thing as tears also can be prompted more readily by direct language. I mean, I think it's the same kind of physiological, emotional responses which can come about through real clarity about mm-hmm. how do humans behave to one another.
And I'd love, I love that there's a line towards the end of The Woman Back from Moscow where Yume is wondering what kind of revolution this is.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful line. And it's this again, written so sparely, but it just, for me, it had this subversive element where you're throwing a new light, and all three of these works are throwing new light on these things that these myths and these stories and these structures of belief that we have held in one way for a long time.
Sure, in a way that really undermine all the kind of communist, the grand statement, the narrative. In fact, the Paralink, he wrote a long review on this book for the New York Review of Books. The first sentence is, this book will be denounced in Beijing. In fact, in a way, I'm mentally prepared for that because it is kind of a really counter official kind of narrative.
And isn't it so important to give space for that?
Yes.
And isn't it so important that we are all here, part of that conversation? What I'd like to do, I have more questions, but I'd like to be mindful of time, and I want to make sure there's many of you here, and I want to make sure you have the chance to ask your questions. There are two microphones in the center, so if you want to come forward and bring any questions that you have, I hope that you will. Yes, please. Now.
I've been waiting for the opportunity. I happen to be taking an adult ed class now on the Iliad, and one of the most important questions that keeps cropping up, which I'd like to ask Emily about, concerns how do we respond to the frequent intervention of the gods? And in this space particularly, one has to point out that the gods that are referred to are not our gods, and it's hard to deal with these fantastic stories. Let me give you a point your attention to just two examples. The dysfunctional relationship between Hera and Zeus, whereby she seduces him to distract his attention from the war, and he gets angry after he has a good time. And then much later, when one of the gods, the river god, gets angry at Achilles because he's stuffing the water up with corpses. Could you tell us how we deconstruct or deal with these God stories.
So the question, as I understand it, is how do we deal with the God stories? I mean, for me as a translator and also as a teacher of the Iliad and the Odyssey, it seems essential to convey that they should seem totally real. There were people in antiquity, particularly in late antiquity, who read the gods as allegorical. Their symbol, Athena is a symbol of wisdom, Hera is a symbol of institutional power. These just represent abstract things, that Ares is war not, or aggression, not necessarily a real being in the world. And it seems to me crucial that while you're in the world of the poem, they should feel real in the way that human beings feel real, but with the crucial difference that they don't die. And so that we should have this awareness that this poem, the Iliad, represents three totally different societies, the society of Troy, the society of the Greek encampment, and the society of Olympus. And Olympus gives us this way of imagining what would it be like to have a society where feelings were just the same, but it goes on forever, and there's no possibility of death. And these family, these toxic family relationships and power dynamics are still there. The gap between genders is quite different on Olympus because, of course, the ways that mortal men exploit mortal women doesn't quite apply when it's applying to immortal goddesses. I mean, for me as a translator, it was also just mostly important to think through how can I make the movements of the gods feel totally different from normal human movement. So when Thetis appears from the waves, you should believe here are the waves, and then all of a sudden the goddess is here. Or here's the river, and it seems like a regular river, and now he's rising up and it's a flood. So I think it also speaks to the way the poem is about natural disaster and the way the whole world is alive, including the natural world. And the gods are very often much more closely associated with the natural world than human beings quite realize. I mean, there's the power of fire, and that's also Hephaestus. There's the power of the rivers, and that's also a god. The world is all alive.
All right, so Ms. Moore, you brought up this great point that you made up a lot for your book, and it's kind of like that's something like I personally grapple with, and I've read about like with journalists that like they always have bias. They always put something into their work, and all three of you are doing that. You're translating or talking about historical moments, and I'm kind of curious, like, my first question is like, do you actively think about that? Do you actively think about the messages you're sending? And secondarily, I've been like reading translations, say, by Anne Leckie, and one of the big things in that book is about like the power of translation, how when you're the only like point of contact between two civilizations, you kind of have like ultimate power over what happens. And I guess this is less for more, but for you two, like, you're Emily Wilson, like, you translated, like, that's what your book's all about. So I'm curious, like, how you feel about that and the power of translation.
Susanna, do you want to go?
That's for me?
It can be for both of us, right?
All three of you.
I had two different questions about, like, the biases you put in to your works. Do you think about them, the messages you're sending with this historicity, and then, like, the power of translation?
I have to say, I'm not sure what the question
is. So it's and excuse me if I'm wrong, but it's about the, you know, when you're dealing with the bones of an historical narrative, and then you're, you know, fictionalizing, like you had said at the beginning, you're fictionalizing quite a bit, like you're making up quite a bit. You're taking license and liberty, but to get at, you know, it's that intersection between retelling, reinvention, and translation. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are certain things that are very difficult, like language. You know, I was reading the other day in an essay someone wrote, alas appears in almost every poem, but have you ever heard anyone say it? You know, yeah. So that to find a way for the characters to speak in 1850, mm-hmm. or to find the way for the Native Americans to speak, was a dilemma. How do I do that without it being pedantic or stiff? Or, and then how do people think differently? You know, I mean, if this was about the talk was about myth, you know, she arrives believing in the myth, you know, of what American Indians were supposed to be like, and slowly she begins to change, but she's a victim of her own myth, you know, of who she is as a white woman. So it's very complicated and not easy. You know, a lot of writing, people who don't write seem to think it's about, you know, inspiration, or the muse is sitting on the edge of your desk with her legs crossed. When it's really solving problems. I have this, how do I get this? I have that, I want to be over here. How do I do it? And it sometimes takes a long time to figure it out.
I mean, I think the translation is exactly the same thing. If I have this, how do I get to this? And I mean, I guess one thing I would say is just that I try to start with empathy, and with empathy to all the characters and to the text and to my own readers, and sort of thinking through how can I be deeply responsible and deeply empathetic to and responsive to each of those different kinds of responsibilities and to different kinds of truths. And if I'm telling the truth about this is what this character is saying, I mean, if I just write out the Greek, I'm telling the truth, but I'm not actually conveying the truth. If I write out a prose translation, I'm not conveying the rhythmicality. If I write out something which conveys this is sort of what it means, but the tone is all wrong, or this makes this character sound ridiculous in a way that the original character might not sound ridiculous. There are so many different kinds of truth.
Yes.
I mean, I also feel that, it's a huge responsibility to be a translator or to be a retailer, but also there are many, many others too. I'm not the only one, which in a way lets me off the hook. So I think my job is also to do something different, because I don't think there's any point in doing a translation that's exactly the same as, you know, a dozen other contemporary translations. So, I mean, for instance, using meter hadn't been done nearly as much in the course of the last 150 years as you'd think it might be. So I think I felt I had to both interrogate my own preconceptions and interrogate my own sort of positionality, and also figure out what can I add that isn't there already in translations of these texts.
Thank you so much.
And I think in addition to all the messages we might convey, I think there is also we have to be another kind of loyalty, that is to the book you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to treat the book as an object of art, so it has its own logic and demands. Mm-hmm. So very often, I think you have to decide whether you should be faithful to your project or to history. If you write a literary work, basically you want to transcend history, but of course you have to start and rooted in history, in actual happening. But ultimately, you really want to let the book want to make the book stay for a long time. So that's another part. I think for me, I'm more concerned with what is new in this book, what can make this book more interesting compared with other great novels.
And what does that mean to transcend history? I love that. Like, I understand that intuitively in terms of my own work, but I'm really curious about that. You know, and I'd love each of you to, like, what does that mean in your work, in these stories that you've chosen?
Let me give you an example. For instance, there have been so many books on, you know, the Dust Bowl migration in the mid-century, last century. But only, basically, all the novels only The Grapes of Wrath, that survived. But look at the book. In fact, he did a lot of new things artistically. The interchapters basically play with all the stretch, the possibilities, see how many voices can be included, all kinds of diction, all levels of diction. In other words, that book made that all the techniques, all the new devices make the book very expansive. So as a result, it is a piece of history, but it still is relevant to our time. So in that sense, basically, it really stays against the time. That is a great example of literature. Really, we all want to write a book that can stand against time.
And that has an integrity. Like,
So
for you, Emily, the integrity of, you know, your work, you know, your work of translation, you know, it is what allows us to experience this story in a new way.
I hope so. I mean, as you were talking about transcending history, I was thinking, how can we possibly know? I mean, I was thinking about the way Homeric heroes are always yearning for eternal glory, for aphthiton kleos. And Hector imagines that there's going to be a mound built to memorialize a man who he himself will slaughter, and that will memorialize him. But then we also hear how the Greeks labor long and hard to build the wall around their encampment, and it's this marvelous piece of engineering. And then we learn also from the narrator that Poseidon and Apollo will make all the rivers run together and flood the whole plain, and all of human achievement will be washed away. So who knows? Maybe we'll all be forgotten.
And there's a line at the end of The Lost Wife when Sarah's husband turns to her and with some, I don't know, scorn may not be the right word, but says, "You are a part of history now." And yet for her, what she feels is that she has lost, you know, both worlds. Like she is in that, you know, she's not a part of either world anymore.
No. And that's because of, again, because of mythology.
Right.
No, he means it too in the sense of, which is also quite modern, of celebrity.
Right.
Newspapers,
right.
Talk. Right. But that,
but her emotional experience is that she doesn't belong to either. Yes.
No, she's lost.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, hello. Hello. May possibly hypothetically get at sort of what you've been talking about already, because it's sort of like the last question, but the way I've been thinking about it in my head is a lot more confusing. So if you'll permit me, I'm about to like try to use a metaphor. So when I first read the name of this talk, Deconstructing Myth, I was like, ooh, that's alarming. Because like the boundary between deconstructing something and breaking it, possibly so it can never be built again, is so close. It's a very, very thin line to walk. And the way I was thinking about it later was like, okay, so say in terms of like a myth, you have a corpse, and the corpse is like of someone who is and was really, really important to you and also to other people. And then with your writing powers, because you're a magic writer, you can either honor the corpse with a funeral, in which case it will stay dead. Or you could accidentally desecrate the corpse and ruin it and make it like something you don't particularly like, that other people don't particularly like, that clouds the like wonderful things that this person actually did in real life. Or, and this is a riskier option, but you could breathe new life into it and resurrect it again, which would be so special, especially in terms of the Iliad, which is like the only sort of like story I'm familiar with. You could by breathing new life into that story, you could grant Achilles the immortality, at least a bit of the immortality, that he was so scared that he would never get, that he fought so hard for. Or this, that's the way I interpret it. But also, like seeking to resurrect it that way, you risk, mudding it even more. So, like, how do you guys all sort of, like, reckon with that, if that makes any sense whatsoever? So sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. That was great. That made sense to me. I mean, I see myself as much more of a reconstructor than a deconstructor. I mean, I see myself as constructing a new vision for how, like, for the particularities of the words in which Homeric poetry can be told. But I don't see myself as sort of taking it apart. I mean, obviously the image that you gave us was pretty scary. I mean, I don't necessarily want to be a necromancer because that tends to go wrong when people do it. But I do see myself as sort of trying to have the winged words have new wings or flutter in a different way in this language which didn't exist when Homeric poetry was composed, but for those words still to be flying through the skies and through the air.
I think I was taking things apart. Certainly the myth of the Native American, which most of us grew up with, which was, although there are many different families and tribes, was based mainly on the Sioux with feather hair pieces and bows and arrows and great horsemen riding, chasing the buffalo. And then also, you know, the other myth was one of the West. The American imagination was promised, the American people were promised land, which had a profound effect given the millions of uprooted people who had settled our country. So that did not turn out so well for many. The idea of who the American Indian has changed, but I mean, I'm older than a lot of you, but I remember one of my favorite television shows when I was a child in the 50s was Cochise. Did any of you see Broken Arrow or Cochise, in which there was one good Indian, one, and he was a chief, of course. No women. There are great examples. I remember being shocked and inspired by a book called Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, in which he demolishes the myth and leaves you no solace. There's no comfort. You know, you are just sort of in despair. So, Hajin, what do you think?
I think deconstruction and the construction happen at the same time. Mm-hmm. When you write a book, basically, or you do a translation, you have to reconstruct something. So the two are not separable.
Great. I want to thank all of you so much for being here. This was...
Do we have time for one more question?
One more question? Do we have time for one more question? Okay, we have time for one more question. Thank you.
Mine's actually quite quick.
Okay.
It is a question for Emily, and it's kind of trivial, but I was just curious, the whole technique of writing in rhythm and in meter, you're given this text and you're trying to use specific words, but then you have to put it in meter. And I thought, how hard? Was that difficult? It seems incredibly difficult. Did it get easier? Did you get in a groove? Did you start thinking that way? Or
it got easier, yes. It was very difficult. I mean, I started doing it many years ago. My first published translations were of Seneca's tragedies, and I was much looser with the meter in that first project, and I got much better at having control over the rhythm and having control over how regular I wanted the meter to be, which I wanted it to be very regular because the original is very regular. I mean, I did a lot of reading out loud, both of the original and of my drafts in progress, and I felt writing by hand and also reading drafts out loud helped me figure out if it doesn't sound right, then I have to throw it away and start over and figure out some other solution. I'm not going to say it was super easy, but it was a totally satisfying kind of challenge.
Oh. Yeah. Also, writing a novel is not that different.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yes. Rhythm matters for any piece of writing, I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just to remind that the books are going to be sold in the back, and Hajin, Emily, and Susanna will be signing. So thank you.
Thank you.